Something Wicked has this week come to Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater. It's Jack O'Brien's occult-inspired version of Shakespeare's Macbeth, starring Ethan Hawke and Anne-Marie Duff in her Broadway debut as Lady Macbeth. In this very visual production, evil osmosis everywhere, the witches reappear in other roles throughout the evening, and the stage of the Beaumont has been transformed as an eerie black mandala, a graphic astrological projection that seems to seep into everything. Whether it's there to protect Macbeth and the audience from evil or to ensnare it, well, that is, to quote Shakespeare, the question. The show plays until January 12th, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ethan Hawke, Anne-Marie Duff, and Jack O'Brien to our show today. Hello.
Hey there.
And have I already flirted with bad luck by not referring to it as the Scottish play?
Not as far as I'm concerned. How do you feel about that, guys?
Well,
I actually had a British actor say to me, don't ever say that. I said, but we're not in a theater. And he said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, the reason for the not saying it in a theater is so sort of mundane, really. It's because in the days of repertory theatre, if you were doing a show and it wasn't going terribly well, quite often they would bring Macbeth in because it was a guaranteed ticket seller. So if you heard the companies start saying the word Macbeth, 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 it meant you were in trouble. So it's not really that glamorous a story.
And it turns out that when I think back over the past 5 or so years, we've had a fair number of productions of Macbeth in New York, maybe the last 10 years. Why do you think this play continues to resonate and attract audiences?
Oh, you go over there. You do that, please, Ethan.
Ethan?
Why does it? I don't. You know.
I mean, more than you've played Hamlet in the films, but even more than Hamlet, Macbeth seems to really attract audiences.
I think it's incredibly approachable of all the great plays. It also begs for artists to contribute to it. It's a play that wants a director to have a vision for it. It's wildly interpretable, which makes it endlessly fun to play. And also for the reason that Anne-Marie just said, audiences want to see it. And there's something about, why does Abbey Road get played all the time? Why does To Kill a Mockingbird keep selling? It needs to be seen.
There's also that thing about people's fascination about evil. I mean, you know, the snake has all the lines, that sort of thing, where we think, you know, a good person is a little bit, we get a little irritated at people who are just above us. But
we know exactly what a good person's going to do.
Or should do.
Yeah.
But we're thrilled to know that evil people, you know, make mistakes. And I think there's something sort of humane and also, let's face it, it's some of the greatest poetry ever written. I mean, you know, I love these plays and I know them really quite well. But you are stunned as to how many quotable, memorable lines are stitched into that fabric. It's just extraordinary.
Is the biggest question Macbeth presents whether evil comes from within or from without?
I think that's something that Jack plays with in this play more so than most productions. I think it's been terribly fashionable to make it purely a one-man show, a complete growth of psychosis, as opposed to seeing if there could be any external elements. But we live in such a sort of secular world, certainly the Western world is obsessed with the lack of God, that I think that it's nice to play around with magic and have other forces at work. I think that's exciting.
Do the witches create something in Macbeth, when they give him the prophecy, or do they just recognize a fatal flaw in him that's already been there?
Well, one of the most fascinating things to me about the whole rehearsal process is that I learned from Jack in this is that, you know, the witches come to Macbeth on a very interesting day, a day in which he's won not one but two battles. And there's a great lesson in there about when we're at our most vulnerable is when we're high on ourselves. And I think that Jack's production certainly makes a case to be made that if you're looking for witches, you will find them wherever you go.
I always have.
Jack, is it fair to say that one of the great qualities Ethan brings to the role is his kind of everyman likability?
Well, that's a lovely way of putting it. I would say it's the transparency of his heart, having had the opportunity to work with him, you know, before in other contexts. to the fact that he brings such an extraordinary amount of energy into the arena, and it's also vulnerable. It's also, he puts it completely at the disposal of the work. That you know, it's you're conducting a great sort of instrument, and he can play it any way you want him to.
But he plays him as somebody that we can identify with, so it is all the more horrifying when he begins to murder.
Well, it was what we were all fascinated about as we sort of immersed ourselves in this, is that he's not a priori an evil person. He's an opportunist, and he says he's ambitious, but he's fascinated because he's so swollen with victory when we first see him.
But even when he says he's ambitious, he's saying it in the context of saying, I shouldn't be.
I shouldn't be, yeah.
He's not like saying, oh, I need, it's not like Richard, I need this, I want this. He's saying, I have nothing to spur my intent, but ambition, which he's saying in the context as a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then the witches have predicted.
Than somebody blind with ambition.
Yeah, I know.
The witches have predicted that he'll become the Thane of Cawdor, and he can come that without taking any action on his own. So on his own, why not just trust the prediction? Emery, is that where Lady Macbeth comes in?
Maybe.
Takes two bad drivers to have an accident.
Yeah. We meet her when she's alone reading Macbeth's letter telling her what happens, and she determines he shall be king.
Yeah, she's a pretty impatient individual, isn't she? I've often thought about that, actually. That's one of the sort of character problems, isn't it, really, why they don't trust this universe. But I think it's a sort of vicarious hunger, isn't it? I think it has a lot to do with that. And also, we made such a conscious decision that they should be so madly in love with each other that actually it's so profound, the need for your other half, as we'd say at home, to be more of themselves, to be as much of themselves as they can be. So I think it comes from that.
So she's ambitious for Macbeth rather than just for herself.
I think certainly for herself as well. That's why I use the word vicarious. I do think she's unfulfilled too.
But why do you think that, unlike Macbeth, Lady Macbeth never wavers from her ultimate purpose?
Because she doesn't spiral into psychosis. She doesn't. She has she sees the end goal and is sated and also has a burgeoning conscience about it.
There's that great line about Macbeth being too full of the milk of human kindness, mm-hmm. and that there's something inherently good about him that's going to prevent him from doing this, and that she doesn't seem to think she has herself. And you, Jack, I think it's beautifully done in the show. I really love what you guys have. I mean, the reason why she doesn't appear with him in the later parts of the play is, in a lot of ways, what she wants is for them to rise together. And even though he becomes king, she loses him because he couldn't handle doing this.
Yeah, it's a kind of Peter Principle situation, isn't it? I always saw them as a kind of golden couple stuck in the corner. That they both knew, beautiful and glossy and accomplished and athletic and sexy as they are, they sort of thought, why are we here in this little lane? Shouldn't we be on the highway, you know? And suddenly they get the idea, and it all happens so quickly.
But would it be convention of Shakespeare's time that you look for the woman to blame, cherchez la femme?
Yeah. Well, people, that's so interesting, Leonard, that you bring this up, because there's a sort of simplistic reduction that people always want to do with this play. Oh, she made him do it. And you think to yourself, we're all of us dying, Miss Barrett. I mean, you know, we're all guilty. And we're all guilty of creating our own mislegends, if you want to put it that way. So, no, I don't blame anybody. I think it's all very even-handed.
And then there's the whole matter of sex. I mean, they are obviously very attracted to each other.
Honestly, it's something worth reflecting. It's probably the best marriage in Shakespeare. I mean, he writes courtship gloriously, but he doesn't have much good to say about marriage. And you look very long and hard to find a good married couple. Maybe the Fords are in good shape in Merry Wives. You know, you can't make much of a case for that. But the Macbeths are they're partners. They're a very modern couple.
On the other hand, when he tells her that he won't kill Duncan in his home and tells her to speak no more on this matter, she kind of responds by questioning his manhood.
But that's, and I hope to God that I'm able to do it as a storyteller, but that I refer back to what I was saying earlier on about trying to sort of inspire him. As opposed to, I don't think it's reductive. I don't think it is that. I think it's trying to. And I think, in my head, the whole balloon of manliness becomes something about self fulfillment. I mean, I'm sure lots of people.
So it's
would
the
laugh
carrot, not the stick.
Exactly, but that's my rationale.
And she thinks that's what she's good for, right? That she should be, if she's any good at her job as being a wife, she should be a real help to him in that respect.
My guests are Jack O'Brien, who has directed the current production of Macbeth at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater. And also with us are Ethan Hawke, who plays Macbeth, and Anne-Marie Duff, who plays Lady Macbeth. We mentioned earlier this is one of the more accessible of Shakespeare's plays. Do you think it's because, well, we know the language, we know so many of those speeches because it's been performed so much, and or is it because Shakespeare was really at top form when he wrote this?
Well, it seems to follow Hamlet. We think it happened after that. So we understand where he is in his development. He's found the soliloquy. He's perfected it as the sort of intellectual close-up. He now has that in his bag, and he's written one of the most enigmatic and glorious characters that we will ever know in Hamlet. And where do you turn next? We all have this problem. What are you going to do next season?
Well, for you, Ethan, it's been Hamlet, now Macbeth, and I imagine somewhere down the line you're going to want to do Lear.
Someday.
That has been a progression for a lot of actors, hasn't it?
Well, there's a few roles before then.
There are a few roles, yes. You've got a few others to fill in there.
Well, you have to do another Sunrise film.
Yeah. I'll slide one of those in there somewhere.
It's the Hannon exercise for the fingers, isn't it? I mean, these are the great parts by which we all ascend to some degree control over our artistry.
Anne-Marie, Lady Macbeth, clearly uses sex as a weapon, but she then asks to be unsexed. And you played St. Joan in London. Didn't Joan of Arc also have to unsex herself?
Yeah, but very different. I think I think Lady Macbeth's referring to a thought process, a way of thinking.
But both outrageously ambitious.
Yes, but and both desperate to thrive in their own version of success. Yes, but I think it's a different version of desexualizing and a means to an end.
Now, Jack, where does the...
I think you guys just want to use the word unsex because it's so kind of interesting to hear over and over again.
Well, Shakespeare used it. Yeah. Where does the Mandela come from? I usually associate that with Asia.
Well, I'll be honest, it appeared before me as if in a dream. It wasn't my idea at all. I mean, Scott Pask, who is our brilliant designer and was in every ways a partner in all of this, suddenly one day we were having a design meeting with Kathy Zuber, the costumier, and we were meeting together a lot of it, so we tried to get everything consistent in our visions, and there was this thing. And I said, what is that? And they all asked me, do you know about Dr. D? And I said, shamefacedly, no, I don't. And he was this sort of philosopher, astronomer, astrologer, Coombs scientist, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare's and Elizabeth, and very conceivably the prototype for both Prospero and conceivably Lear. But anyway, apparently Shakespeare knew him. And he had the second largest library in London. And so a lot of the research must have been done there. He had this guy that he knew. And he constructed these extraordinary mandalas in order to speak with the angels. That's what he thought he was doing. And his assistant didn't know Latin, so he put a lot of Latin in there, so no one could know what he was actually saying to the angels or what they were saying back. I just loved this idea. And first of all, I thought it extremely beautiful, but then I thought, oh, I know. I'll just put the company on a platform of prayer, and they'll be all right.
Emery, is it more fun to play someone who becomes evil than Juliet?
Being the evil person you are.
Being the wicked witch that I am.
I was just suggesting that.
Of course it's more fun. It's exactly that thing that Ethan was just saying about the unpredictability of these characters. And yeah, and it's always very rewarding to be a loose cannon.
Ethan Hawke, on another level, will be doing a toast, boast, or roast to Austin Pendleton on January 13th at the Players Club. That's at 8 p.m. at 15 Gramercy Park South. For details on that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Also, for details about tickets to this production of Macbeth at the Vivian Beaumont at Lincoln Center. How long is the run?
We go to the 12th of January.
And my great thanks to Jack O'Brien, Ethan Hawke, and Anne-Marie Duff for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
We loved it. Mm-hmm.